Welcome, everyone, to another extraordinary episode of Podcasting Them Softly. I'm Frank, and I'm joined by my BFF, Nick. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
I'm doing excellent. Today, we are very excited to announce and introduce artist and actor Stephen Lack to join our Actor Spotlight series. All of our listeners will instantly recognize Stephen as Cameron Vale in David Cronenberg's 1981 classic Scanners. He then reteamed with Cronenberg in the role of Andreas Wallach in Dead Ringers. He was also featured in Larry Cohen's Perfect Strangers, Michael Grant's Head On, and Alan Moyle's Rubber Gun, which Stephen also co-wrote. Please check out Stephen's website, stephenlackart.com, to get a glimpse at his fantastic neo-expressionist artwork. For our listeners in New York, Stephen's work is on display at the Castor Gallery on the Lower East Side throughout September. Mr. Lack, thank you so very much for joining us. This is an incredible honor.
Oh, God, I'm so grateful to be able to, you know, dispense honors.
Yeah, thanks a lot for coming on. Actually, you know, we knew we were going to have you on the show, and I revisited Scanners last night, and it still remains as insane now as it did the last time I saw it, which was 15 years ago close, and the time before that, which was in high school. You know, I just have to ask right off the bat, and I'm sure we'll bounce around a bit, but how did your involvement with Scanners come about?
Oh, you know, I can give you a nice straight answer. I was making the Head-On film with Michael Grant. But I had met David a couple of years earlier, about 3 years earlier. We had met in Cannes. I think that was the official meeting. That's what we tell all our wives. And, yeah, it was at the Cannes Film Festival, and I was there promoting, I guess it was 1978, so I was promoting Rubber Gun, talking to people it might be available for home distribution one of these days. I'm kind of negligent in follow-through when it comes to bureaucratic-type things. I just like to be, you know, amused on a daily basis by whatever is fresh rather than resuscitating or polishing what has already happened. Although I will talk about it, and that's what we're doing. Ah, yeah.
Perfect.
He's here. So, yeah. So how did I meet Cronenberg? You know where we met? You're going to love this. Well, we met at Cannes, but he knew I was into cars, and I knew he was into cars, so he invited me to join him at the Monaco Grand Prix, just a couple of kilometers away. Welcome to Euro measurements. And
the rest of the world's measurements, aside from America's, yes.
Exactly.
I've heard about them.
But there's nothing as cozy as the bubble, except for the gunfire. Anyway, yeah, so we hung out during the Monaco Grand Prix 78, and that's where we bonded. There's other details, of course, best hidden. But there we go.
Yeah, this is so cool because Scanners, for me, has remained one of my favorite films ever since I saw it when I was way too young to see it, and a lot of it has still scarred me to this day. I don't know. I guess I have 1,000 questions, but one that came to mind earlier, as the lead in the film, do you watch that film ever?
Yeah. I do. I mean, being in a film is a very surreal experience. I mean, you work very intensely. You generate a family over a three-month period, and then everybody disperses, and the only record left is something that's more detailed than any kind of snapshots you're going to get from, you know, vacationing with the family. So I have seen the film. I didn't think I would be watching it again. I just watched it a couple of months ago in Toronto, where it had its 35th anniversary. And they have a thing, Films Canada, where every territory in Canada that's ever had a film associated with it has a projection on that specific day. Kids can stay out of school and all of that. It's a wonderful festival. And I guess they show about 40 films across Canada, and Toronto chose Scanners to do it, and it was on its 35th anniversary, so they dragged me out of whatever miasma I'm constantly in to go up there and talk to their people. And in such an event, this is tedious. I saw it again. There we go. I added some freshness to that tonality. I saw it again. And I was happy that it held up. And I saw David. I was happy he was holding up. And there we go.
And in this day and age of remakes, are you surprised that there hasn't, in the last few years, maybe there hasn't been some sort of like big budget reimagining? Or are you happy that this has not occurred?
Well, I'm happy that it hasn't occurred because I love the pristine mess. Like, did your wife, you know, even if you had a divorce, you just want to make sure she never has sex again. So it's the same way with the film, I guess. I don't want to look at somebody trying to be or replacing me. I don't want to be replaced, but it's inevitable. And I think it's a great film, and I think so many things have spun off of it, like Fringe and The X-Files and things like that. So I wouldn't be surprised that it will happen, and I've already heard for years that it was happening. And then they did those three awful sequels that were unintelligible that went nowhere, you know, Scanners 2, 3, and 4 or something like that.
So, I've never seen
right.
Yeah, it'll happen.
Yeah, I haven't seen any of the Scanner sequels either. I've been obviously very leery to check them out. At any point were you approached to reprise your role or a variation of your role? No?
No, stupid of them. I mean, I even wrote one or an outline of one just in case, you know, about 2 years after we did Scanners, you know, because I started to really understand the script by then.
And what was your initial reaction to the premise? And were you offered the role that you got like right off the bat? Did you have to audition? Like, what was the?
I was offered the role right away. I was doing Head On, which has its moments, and luckily the moments were during the first 2-3 weeks of shooting, before things got a little fuzzy. For others, and anyway, so I had a great reputation at that time because Rubber Gun was very critically received, and so this the first 3 weeks of Head On were also getting good reviews through the gossip of the PAs and the directors and whatever other press was allowed on. So that was cool. So David approached me. And I looked at it, and I said, why not? Also, I had worked on another project with a friend of mine, David Blue, and he said, you know, never refuse to be in a film. Well, after I did Scanners, I did refuse to be in a lot of films.
I recently watched your interview on the Criterion Collection Blu-ray for Scanners, and I like the part where you speak of you were the highest paid actor in Canada around that time.
Yeah, I like that too. That was amazing.
And I think it's another interesting thing I think is great about Scanners and a lot of early Cronenberg stuff is that they're Canadian films, and I think that a lot of people don't associate the two.
Well, Canada does have or did have, and it probably continues to have through various representatives, a very strong art movement, and it's based on the availability of space in Canada and the environment that, you know, makes you want to play in that space, you know, makes you feel part of it or not, you know, alienated. But, yeah, there's a lot of great conceptual work that came out of Canada at the same time that Scanners was being made, because I hung out with a lot of those people. But that said, Canada really did nurture a lot of terrific filmmakers, and its proximity to the United States, culturally as well as geographically, and at the same time, the strangeness, the distance, the admission, the lateral support for being different, gives you a little perspective that you can then play with the material that America provides. That's why you've got such a preponderance of Canadian comedians in the pantheon of America and its giggles, you know?
Yes.
Everyone from the writers of Cher, of course, all my reference points are way back, you know? But people like Dan Aykroyd and John Candy and, you know, a lot of those people, Saturday Night Live, Lauren Michaels, Canadians. Martin Short, Canadian. But getting back, because we're straying here, hold my hand, it's dark. Getting back to the subject of the Canadian filmmakers, so Canada, in its search for identity, did empower a lot of people without track records or with minimal track records, but somehow they proved themselves, and through the bureaucracy, they were empowered to make films. It's a great, great thing. America doesn't quite do that. Everything is market-oriented, and then, as my friend John Joe said, you've got people like George Lucas schlepping out the tired old thing, I'm going to make art films now that I've made billions. You know what I mean? And so let them try. But Canada did make a lot of art films, a lot of personal things between the director and his heritage, usually. And, of course, David's heritage is probably one of borderline insanity as a geek reading science fiction in high school, you know?
Were you, when you were making Scanners, did you have any sense that it was going to have the, or generate the sort of following that it would eventually do? And did, you know, what was your initial take on making it? What was the vibe? Because it's such a, it's this like unique movie in that it's grotesque and it's horrifying, but it's also very playful in this weird way. And it seems strange, very strange to me, that it hasn't been given the big remake treatment, because the idea is so catchy. And like you said, like it's a precursor to something like The X-Files or Fringe. There's all sorts of elements about it that are, you know, they're just very solid genre elements. So what was your thought when you were making the film?
Oh, you're just busy trying to get it done. You know, you're trying to just do justice to it. I have to say, right from the beginning, I was impressed with David's imagination. And I knew the things that happened too quickly, which is why you become a painter, so that you can control the input and re-excrete it at your own pace. So I knew that this pace was beyond my manipulation, so I just put myself in David's hands, as horrifying as that might be, and I let him guide me, you know? And, of course, I imposed my own instincts onto things and impressions and interpretations, but it was going very quickly. There wasn't a lot of lead time. I had been working on another film before that, head on, where we had 10-hour turnarounds, which meant you were in front of the camera 14 hours a day. You had 1 hour to get to and from a bed and 8 hours to sleep in it and try and squeeze a little shower and shaving in between the two of those things. So when I got into Scanners, like I said, I was not prepared to do much of an interpretive role, rather than just let David tell me what to do. Although, of course, when you're in that and every line you're given is a question, you do kind of imbue it with a bit of Alice in Wonderland, maybe? How am I doing? Do I sound like a robot?
No, you sound awesome.
Oh, thank you. I need that. I need that.
You sound fabulous.
You know, you can't smell the incense on the phone.
You kind of, I guess, asked and answered my next question, but what's it like being in David Cronenberg's hands, aside from horrifying?
Super manipulated, and I love it, because I'm very manipulative, and, you know, I guess I am. The only difference is he has better motivation and better focus. I'm just like a brat in the fucking, you know, sandbox. But yeah, I just dig his vision, and I like to think we're still friends and have been ever since this experience. And, you know, in Rubber Gun, which, like I said, may come out in a year for the home video market. I don't know. I can't predict anything. But in that movie, I'm a completely different creature than I am in Scanners. And in that movie, that's what David saw, and that's why he cast me, because he said, this guy is either a maniac or the best actor in the world. Well, I think he's settled on maniac, but, you know, I can focus the mania. Otherwise, how would Dexter ever get out of the mall?
Okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm not saying anything. I'm just reveling in the dead time, bitch. Just kidding.
Are you a fan of horror movies, like this, the type of movie that Scanners is? Like, is that something that you were a fan of before?
I was into them before. I don't watch too many of them anymore. I just don't, because they demand a lot of attention. And there's, you know, I saw some of Saw, that series, and then there was one about the, Hostel. I thought that was fucking phenomenal. I don't know whether it was Hostel 1 or 2, but it was great. But I don't go out of my way for that entertainment. I kind of cringe when I see gore in things like Game of Thrones and stuff like that. You know, but I mean, I have a wicked imagination, so, you know, even watching Martha Stewart turns into a horror show. You know,
I gotta ask you, I know you've been asked this a billion times, but what was the final climax of Scanners like to shoot? Because that's just watching it to this day. However many years, 35 years later, it's just still frightening and unsettling. Just the practical effect work is amazing in that film.
Yeah, well, you know, I, again, it started off because it was a reshoot. They had done it and it was unsuccessful. And so they had to redo it, and they brought Dick Smith in, and he did an unbelievable job. And when we first met, which was about a month before the actual reshoot, he had a little request. He wanted to see the color of my eyes, although he didn't tell me that's what he wanted. Not that I would have made much of a difference. But they woke me up at 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning after I had been out until 4:30 that very morning. And reminded me that I had this appointment down there to meet Dick Smith, which they didn't explain to me what it was, but, you know, I just followed it because we're all Montrealers, we're all Canadians. Oh, yeah, sure, I'll go down there, okay. Well, okay, you want to know where the cars are? Okay, well, I'll look for the Cutlass at La Fargo. Okay, well, I'll count them. So I went down, and Dick Smith wanted me to look up into the sun so he could take a Polaroid of my eyes. Okay? Now, you guys are film geeks, so you probably don't stay up too late. You know, you probably just need to roll over on your remote to go to sleep late at night. But in those days, i.e. 1980, I guess, you know, you could get exhausted being out till 4:30 in the morning. So the idea of looking up into the sun for Dick Smith's Polaroid was, well, you can see I'm talking nonstop now, and that's 35 years later, so I was much younger and much more excitable, and Dick was trying to get a job done and could not work with my chatter. Of course, I couldn't look into the sun, so we were even, right? So that said, he was not too happy. He kept on asking people, how did I ever get in this business, and what was I, and where did I come from, and how did David get such a creature to be working for him, and all of that stuff. And but later on, when it came time for the, because that was just before the reshoot, it came time for the reshoot, Dick himself got into a bit of trouble. There was a thing, I've told the story a million times, where one of the vein applications, the bladders that had veins that go on my head, it was leaking. And he couldn't figure out where the leak was, and he was losing pressure, and he didn't know what to do. And, of course, you got a crew of 20 people ready to do this filming, and everybody's waiting for you, so your time is costing a lot of money. And that pressure was on Dick, and he was hypoglycemic, so that wasn't helping him any. And but, like I said, David and I met over cars, and David wasn't there. He would have figured it out, but I said, you know, when you have a flat tire and you want to know where the leak is, you put the tire in a bucket of water and you fill it up with air and see where the bubbles come. And he looked at me and he went, genius. So he went and did that, solved his problem, got everything together, and we went off to do the work. And afterwards, you know, he rewarded me greatly for the help. He was an amazing man, Dick Smith.
Now, where did you kind of transition from not being as interested in acting to focusing on your artwork?
Well, I like to channel personalities, and, you know, when you're in the film world, people always think they know who you are or what you are, and they judge that based on the characters that you've played, and I'm already, you know, borderline detached, so I just found it to be an unpleasant burden to be anything for anybody, so I chose to withdraw. I didn't want to, having been through the 50s and the 60s, I didn't want to wait until I was Dwight Eisenhower's age or Churchill's age to start painting. I figured this is what I do and I've always done. I was an artist before David drafted me, but I did that because, you know, when you're a painter and you're living in Bohemia, i.e. the art side of town, and somebody comes knocking on your door that's got an agenda, and they say, what are you doing? And you've only got a wet paintbrush in your hand and no marketplace. You say, nothing. So why don't you help us out with this? So, I mean, I guess you know from the rap I've already laid down that I can manipulate words and even emotions when I have to. Although David didn't need any emotions, I was just a scanner. And as such, how did I feel being a scanner? So there you go. Like that one? I love that trick.
Yeah, the movie really has taken on a truly multiple lives. I mean, again, I was born in 1980, so I saw this movie when I was probably the first time I saw it was when I was in high school, and it was when I first started to get into David Cronenberg's early stuff. I'm a fan across the board. I love his new stuff. I love his old stuff. I think he's a great filmmaker, and when he's on, he's really on. But this movie is definitely one of those films that's had, I think, multiple lives, and it continues to thrive because it's just such a fun movie. And obviously, you get all the, you know, all the exploding heads that you could ever want in one movie, and you know, crazy, you know, wild gore effects at the end, which would now, of course, be done with CGI, and all of it was done, you know, practically, which is always so much more fun, at least for me. And It's just a unique film to be a part of, and I think that I can only imagine how you must feel when people constantly bring it up to you.
Well, they bring it up in the oddest of places, you know, and of course all the elements that you mentioned are, you know, what raises it above. Although there's other things that are really interesting in the film that are so prescient. The fact that, you know, the father worked for a drug company. The father had two sons, that he experimented the drug on his sons. and that the corporation had bought out the whatever I was going to say, literary rights, but you know what I mean, had bought the patent for the drug and wanted to produce it commercially, although the originator of the formula felt that it was not really something that the public or the military should be using, right? So those are elements that are very rarely, as a matter of fact, I've never been asked about them, but that's kind of what also puts the film into a very special category. It's one of the first films that deals with that. And it's not just weaponry, but it's pharmaceuticals. Consec, the pharmaceutical company. And we filmed that at a place called Hoffman-LaRoche. And Hoffman-LaRoche itself, I'm very happy that they provided them with permission to film when the helicopter lands. That is a Hoffman-LaRoche building in the background. What's interesting about that is the entire 2-3 football field size lawn that surrounds the building is actually the roof of a subterranean building in real life. In that location. Yeah. I think a common share of Hoffman-LaRoche was $40K in 1979.
Wow.
Maybe it's a preferred share. I don't know. But it's up there. It's definitely in the 0.001% of corporations.
Yeah, you bring up an excellent point about that. With the militarization of scanners and stuff, and I think that's what makes this film so special and sets it apart from it just being like a horror film or just being a film that relies on like head-popping shock factor. It's very smart, and I think the turn at the end is very subtle. If that makes any sense to you, it's not like this big like Wizard of Oz, man behind the curtain moment that's very cinematically overblown. It's just very quiet.
Yeah.
The big reveal. And yes. I think that's just brilliant.
I'm here. I'm here. Exactly. So, yeah. Yeah, no, David, that's why he's got the following he has, because he imbues all of his projects with that kind of intelligence. No matter how bizarre it all is, or extreme it is, that's almost an obfuscation of what's underneath it. You know, which, you know, I mean, this is about parents betraying children, opportunism, isolation, madness, vengeance, anger. I mean, these are all major human foibles. And, yeah, he does party on those things.
How did you end up reteaming with him for your role in Dead Ringers?
Oh, David felt that maybe he didn't show me at my best in Scanners because, you know, it didn't let me display any range, you know what I mean? So it's like,
right.
So he was hoping that we would squeeze some range in Dead Ringers, and that, you know, I could do some of my specialty, because one of the reasons you asked me earlier, you know, about not being in film anymore, you know, you're handed so much stuff that is so cliche written. I mean, when you're dealing a film, what do you say? Hi, I've got this dance movie. It's like Saturday Night Live, not Saturday, Saturday Night Fever meets Flashdance, except the main dancer was found in the jungle after a plane crash. so it's got a bit of Tarzan in it. You know what I mean? Or some shit like that. Everything is, what archetype are you dealing with? So most of the projects that I was handed were cheap, sleazy, and vapid archetypes that I didn't want to play with. And also, I prefer to tailor dialogue so that it's something that I can play with, and also in the tailoring of it, make it something that I'd want to say in the situation, the paradigm that I have to perform in. So, of course, everybody's got their budgets and their deadlines, and they can't afford to experiment. You know, although I bet I could with Woody Allen, but that never came to pass, because I don't even think that way. God bless him. That's all about relationships, which, that's another kettle of worms. Anyway, so David wanted me to, or was hoping for the opportunity, but lo and behold, he handed me 3 pages of script or mailed them to me and said, do you want to do it? And I said, sure, why not? Sounds good. And went to do it, and I had rewritten the 3 pages to contain some of the madness that he had, in great Hollywood style, expressed the regret of not having already captured. And let's do it this time, Stephen. Well, of course, I got there with my 3 pages that I had memorized and another 5 pages which I was ready to play with, and he didn't have time to read any of it, and actually took the 3 pages and tore 2 of them out and said, actually, we're only going to do this half of the page. So that's what I ended up doing, because they had budgetary and time constraints, as they always do. And after that, I said, that's exactly why I don't do it more often. But I did work with John Jost. I don't know if you know who he is, but he's the complete opposite. Yes, he sets up a structure, and he does want things his way, but he lets you hang yourself, and he practically leaves the room and leaves the camera running on a tripod. So he's much different than the Hollywood style. And we did a project called All the Vermeers in New York, which was for PBS, American Playhouse. We did that in 90. But that and one other film project with John Jost is pretty much all the film I've done, except for the filmed interviews for these reissues. There's one coming out for Dead Ringers.
Yeah, the Shout Factory one. I have that pre-ordered.
Yeah. Well, I hope I'm rewarding. But after talking to me here, you probably say, I've heard that shit before. That guy's only got 1 hour of rap.
No, I'm going to bill this as a podcast and them softly exclusive and get this out before Dead Ringers comes out, so it'll look like Shout Factory copied us. It'll be perfect.
Oh, God, I should have run it by them.
So I want to ask you about your daily skull face posts that you put up on Facebook. I think they are absolutely hysterical. And tell us about Skullface and where this idea came from.
Well, Skullface, he's such a darling. He is something I've always wanted to do, first of all. If you had talked to me when I was 10 years old and said, what do you want to be? I would have said, I want to be a cartoonist. And I don't know where it happened where I got into fine art, but I did. I got into sculpture, which I love a lot. Anyway, the reason I'm saying that is because Skullface has brought me back to this original desire of wanting to be a cartoonist. So, I do the tunes in bed half of the time, like first morning I wake up and I say, what is this miserable bastard going to do to perpetrate more misery on the planet from his desire for power? And I think, you know, this election cycle, it's going to be Labor Day weekend in a few days, so that'll let people locate this on their calendar. But somebody pointed out that in 1960, Labor Day was the kickoff of the presidential campaign.
Jeez.
And now it's a 4-year endurance thing.
Yes.
It's insane. So, I mean, I don't think, you know, I don't think Rome went through this shit. Well, I'm sure it didn't. The people were completely ignorant of anything, and they just, like, shielded themselves from the glitter on the armor as it passed by. So we're in a different syndrome here, and we're changing species. And that's something that David underlines in his work, you know, the mutation of our culture and our individuals and our place in that culture. So we are changing, and we love power, and if we don't have it, we at least want to watch it. It's like sex, right? I mean, and violence. I mean, we watch the killing of so many more people than we've actually killed. We watch the fucking of more people than we've actually gotten it on with, and on and on and on. So Skullface is a manifestation of that. I am Skullface, and I've known Skullface, and Skullface is every politician I've ever seen. So he's everybody. I haven't given him too comedic a profile, but I mean, he just came out of my pen one day. I drew this creature, and then I had him doing mean things. I'd have to have my notebooks with me to remind me which one, because I'm already, I mean, tomorrow's going to be campaign day 61, and so I've already done 60. And for each one of those, there's another page that I didn't show. And for each one of those, there's often two or three other pages that I did show that were ancillary to the day's adventure. So the whole cast and crew, I think they're reflective of some of the characters that were revealed during the Bush administration. Occasionally, you could see hints of a pantsuit on Skullface, so
yes,
there is a touch of Hillary. There was a rant where Latode, of course, which could be anyone from Karl Rove or Roger Iles or Dick Cheney or any malevolent little person. You know, I mean, I've seen some of those people live. It's very scary. And so there we go. And again, you know, coming from having been revered for the job that I did, i.e. scanners, I mean, you guys are talking to me, so I know how power can be abusive, and or not power can be abusive, people can be abusive with their power, and you see that a lot in the celebrity zones, you know. And it's real easy to become cruel and to be detached. And that's another reason to avoid it. But it's also, you know, it's like a fast car. You might want to take it for a drive and run over some people that you never liked. So there you go. So, and I think I don't know if it's available or not, because I'm not, I don't, you know, cruise for videos, because it always ends up costing, or you get viruses, God knows what. But Vimeo, on Vimeo somewhere, I did a piece called The Inside Story with John Jost, where he just put the camera in front of me and I channeled this war criminal for a while. And so it's a 15-minute one-take film, which nobody has really noticed yet. It's never gone viral because it's incredibly boring and malevolent. So it's got a bit of it previews Skullface by a few years, because I did it 2 years ago with John, and there you go. But Skullface, he's a lot of fun, and I can't believe how many people like him. I mean, the likes that I get are only the tip of the iceberg, because wherever I go, people that know me tell me that they're Skullface fans, and I've never seen their names on the list of likes, you know? If I put up a good-looking painting, you know, I've tested Facebook. If you put up an animal or a pretty landscape, and you have a decent following. So let's say you'll get 150 likes on that. Skullface gets about 43 likes now. He's worked his way up from, 10, 15. But, it's interesting. Harsher paintings, they'll get about 80 to 120. It's nice to see how the audience reacts. But they all see it. And so they are seeing Skullface. And now I'm in a dilemma where you get to a point where you've shown how bad he can be, and you've shown some of the bad things that might happen to him, but you also have to now develop it so that, other things have to be in play. So I think it's time I brought in some moderators, some people that are in opposition to Skullface. Other than just public.
Do you know how the Skullface story is going to end?
Absolutely not.
No, it's just sort of like an inspiration per day or week or wherever you see the current headline.
Yes, and I don't think it does end. Should it end?
No, I don't want it to end.
No, I don't think, but even if he weren't to get elected, I think that he'll probably be such a force of nature that maybe even whoever was elected might still have to deal with him as a power factor brokerage instrument.
But what could Skullface be capable of if he didn't get elected? That's one thing that I find fascinating about it, too, is I'm very excited to see the outcome of your fall election.
Yes, the fall election is going to be something. And who knows whether it'll be any of the candidates that we see in front of us.
Oh. I really hope you do something with this post. I don't know. I feel like this is like fertile for a graphic novel or some sort of anthology.
I'll work on that. I'm really a single-celled animal. That's what my ex-partner, Alan Moyle, used to say. I could only do one thing at a time. But I actually do about a quarter of a thing at a time and then move to another thing and then keep on doing it until it's a mosaic. But that said, I am having fun with Skullface, and I've got all the raw material. And if I sit down and concentrate more than the hour a day it takes to come up with the two or three panels that I do, then, yeah, there would be a graphic novel. It does have some continuity day to day, but my attention span is so bad, I have to actually read my notes to remember what I did 3 weeks ago. I suppose that's the same with everybody, but for me, like a good whore, it's always my first time.
Well, thank you so very much for coming on and chatting with us. This has been pretty surreal.
Cool. Well, I'm glad. It should always be surreal, don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, thank you very much. Very cool.
Well, great. Good talking to you.